You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute. Shashank, what stories do you have for us today?
We'll be looking at Egypt, of course, but I think we'll also venture to South Asia, where we'll look at stories to do with the opportunities and challenges of the Indian Navy.
And as that crisis in Egypt spirals out of control, with hundreds killed in the military crackdown, can the country avoid a civil war? And in a preview of this week's Urbanist, I meet two men who are part of London's Mapping Future.
By using this app, you can essentially be standing in a location and look down the street and see how your street looked when it was bombed during the war, or look all the way up Carnaby Street and see what it looked like in the 60s. But it was essentially a kind of time tunnel.
Also on the programme... Andrew, stop giggling so much. No, that, of course, was the sounds of a witch there. We'll head to the first ever exhibition on witchcraft in the United Kingdom. So all that plus, we'll also be checking in with our man in Melbourne. We'll leaf through this morning's French front pages, and we'll also play some music as well. So lots to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's get the latest world headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Further violent clashes are feared in Egypt later, a day after hundreds of people were killed when the government ordered the crushing of camps of supporters of the deposed President Mohamed Morsi. The army-backed government defended its action, saying the authorities had no choice but to act. The health ministry says at least 235 people were killed, with 2,000 injured, but the Muslim Brotherhood claims the death toll is nearer 2,000. America has led worldwide condemnation of the violence, but Isabel Coleman from the Council of Foreign Relations thinks the United States' influence is waning.
At this point, the United States should be using what little leverage left it has, which is its military aid, and recognizing that that leverage is not very great. Clearly, the conversations that have been going on between multiple interlocutors from the U.S. government with the Egyptian government have not had much effect because they've certainly not been encouraging them to take the actions that they're doing.
Among those killed was an experienced British TV cameraman. 61-year-old Mick Dean had worked for Sky News for 15 years. He was married with two sons. Prime Minister David Cameron paid tribute to him.
I want to say how sorry I am about the death of Mick Dean. You know, it's an incredibly brave and important job that he was doing. It's essential that cameramen are in places like Egypt, because otherwise none of us would know what is happening.
The US soldier Bradley Manning has apologised for handing state secrets over to the WikiLeaks website in the biggest breach of classified data in the country's history. The 25-year-old army private told the sentencing phase of his court-martial he was sorry that he'd hurt people and the United States. He said, "I'm apologising for the unexpected results of my actions. The last 3 years have been a learning experience for me." Manning faces up to 90 years in prison for providing more than 700,000 documents, battle videos and diplomatic cables to WikiLeaks. Zimbabwe's Movement for Democratic Change says it will continue to challenge Robert Mugabe's election victory. The party claims there was widespread electoral fraud and it's calling for the result to be declared null and void. Eddie Cross, an MDC member of parliament, told the Monocle Daily that they're taking their case to this weekend's meeting of regional heads of state being held in Malawi.
We have submitted to them a substantial portfolio on the way in which the election was rigged, and we're demanding that they rescind the result and allow us to proceed to continue the reform program until we can hold a free and fair election sometime next year.
Two former JP Morgan employees are facing criminal charges in relation to the trading scandal that cost the bank $6.2 billion. Javier Martín Artajo and Julian Grout are charged with wire fraud and a conspiracy to falsify books and records related to the trading losses. The charges, the first to arise from the so-called whale scandal, say the two deliberately tried to hide hundreds of millions of dollars in losses on trades in a portfolio of synthetic credit derivatives tied to corporate debt. a stuntman who parachuted into the Olympic Stadium dressed as James Bond during last year's opening ceremony, has been killed during a wing diving event in Switzerland. Former Army officer Mark Sutton crashed into a ridge after jumping from a helicopter at a height of nearly 11,000 feet. The event, which was held near the French border, featured the world's top 20 wing divers and was being filmed. A global audience of billions watched Mr. Sutton's jump into the Olympic Stadium last year. Those are the headlines, the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney will be back here in the studio at the bottom of the hour with another check of your world headlines. It is 5 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And welcome back. You are listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Andrew Tuck. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Shashank Joshi. He's a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome to the program,
Very
Shashank. I guess there's only really one story that we've got to talk about that is really dominating all the news coverage today.
Absolutely. We all know the events in Egypt are tragic, hundreds of people dead. This is, of course, not the first massacre that's been perpetrated by the Egyptian army. It's a continuation of a pretty inevitable process, I'd say, one that began with the 3rd of July coup last month, in which the army decided we simply can't live with a brotherhood sharing in any form of power. And that zero-sum logic, on both sides, of course, the brotherhood insisting that their deposed president has to be reinstated, is now inevitably leading to this horrible, horrible clash. But what I think is the most interesting aspect of this story is that the civilian veneer of this government, because of course it is an army-backed government with a pretty apparatchiky interim president, a former head of the Constitutional Court, is now falling apart, that veneer. We have the resignation of Vice President Mohamed El-Baradei, of course the liberal secular figurehead, and even though his political coalition, the so-called National Salvation Front, endorsed yesterday's bloody crackdown, El-Baradei himself has quit, saying he couldn't support this. And I think that's a really interesting trend amidst all the chaos and violence. How does the government react to this now, to react to the army's own missteps?
What's interesting also is, you know, we were talking this morning, if you were, you know, one of these liberal-minded Egyptians who had believed, you know, in the downfall of Mubarak and then had hoped that by backing this coup that you would usher in another period of kind of more liberal politics, there is nowhere, it seems, for the centre ground of Egyptian politics to turn at the moment.
Well, Andrew, I take a bit of a different view. I think you're being overly sympathetic towards that centre ground. They knew what they were doing. And I think when they backed that coup, they went in with their eyes open. They had, of course, experienced this before. We had a post-Mubarak period of a military junta. We saw that. We saw what the army were like. They saw what the army were like, how they dealt with crowds, how they dealt with political opponents, how they dealt with judges. And so they knew what they were getting. And even now, when you have the main liberal secular political bloc, which is a coalition of various parties, endorsing something that is so patently indiscriminate and needlessly violent, I think we have to question whether Egypt's liberals, or most of them at least, are worthy of that label. And I'm increasingly unsure that they are.
But that coalition is now starting to break apart. Leaders from the Coptic Church are starting to say, you know, they're condemning the violence. The university is starting to condemn the violence. So it's not as if that coalition is still as strong
as
it was.
No, and I think you're right. I think that's one of the trends to watch. How does that coalition, which initiated and sustained the protests, which were the wave the military themselves rode to power, how will that now crash, break apart under these horrific pressures? And more importantly, will the army try to find people to co-opt and say, look, it's a civilian government, we're on the roadmap to democracy? Or will they exercise a more naked form of power? Will they simply say, no, it's a military government, we will have our own defense minister, we will have our own people in the ministries? And you may look at something that looks a little more like Pakistan, more of a conventional military dictatorship. I wouldn't rule that out at all.
This morning, the Guardian's editorial says that this is Egypt's Tiananmen Square. But though the odd thing about Tiananmen Square, of course, is that it allowed the Chinese authority to clamp down on dissent for a long, long period. And potentially still today, you see the echoes of that. Do you think this is a Tiananmen Square moment, in that we will see, you know, the grinding down of opposition and, you know, potentially a more peaceful situation in the sense that there's not people being shot on the ground, but a complete loss of political opportunity.
I think that's a very astute point, but I would say what enabled China to build on Tiananmen Square in that way and exploit it was extremely good, extremely deft repression and growth. They legitimated themselves in the international community by becoming one of the world's biggest economies. Egypt, unfortunately, is burning through its limited foreign exchange reserves at an incredible pace with very, very few allies and no prospect of long-term sustained growth in the manner of China. So I'm afraid that sort of trick, repression and then growth and then buy your way to legitimacy, only works if you're very good at it. The Egyptians, I'm afraid, are not very good at it.
Well, we will be getting more on this story out of Egypt in just about 5 minutes from now with our Cairo correspondent, Abdelrahman Hussein. We'll also be joined here in the studio with Abdel Latif El Mawani. He is the former head of news for Egyptian state television. So please do stay with us as we do get more on that story in about 5 minutes from now. But Shashank, you've got a couple other stories up your sleeve.
I do. These are both to do with the Indian Navy. It's had an enormous week, very significant, capped with a bit of tragedy, I'm afraid. You initially had the launch of India's first indigenous nuclear submarine. Its reactor went critical. It'll be years before it can sail deterrent patrols like our own Trident missiles. But this represents a sort of maturity of India's nuclear weapons. Finally, a survivable nuclear force that can roam the Indian Ocean, ready to strike at any moment. Then a few days later, you had the launch of India's first indigenously built aircraft carrier, making it the first Asian country to produce one of these things, and only, I think, the fifth or sixth in the world to possess one. And then, of course, yesterday, a major fire in one of its Mumbai dockyards killed 18 sailors and sunk a major Indian submarine, showing you actually, I think, how far the Indian Navy still has to go, but also how rapidly it's moving ahead.
What's interesting as well is that they're very dependent on what happens in Russia, aren't they? Because most of this kit is being bought either secondhand from Russia or being supplied new from Russia. Do you think that's, you know, an alliance we need to watch? Why is Russia so keen to see a well-armed India, do you think?
Well, it's historic, of course. India and the Soviet Union were key allies. They were both allied from the 50s onwards against China, with whom India had fought a war. They were allied moderately against the United States. So this is a historical legacy. Actually, if you look at it now, it's partly the Russians the only ones willing to give India this stuff. Who else will? The Brits, the Americans, the Chinese? Of course not. But also, the Russians desperately, desperately need the cash. All these big, aging Soviet facilities sitting in the Ukraine and in Russia. Someone has to build these giant ships. Who's buying them? Not the Saudis, not the Emiratis. The Indians are the only ones with cash. But the Indians aren't happy about this. The Admiral Gorshkov, which is an ex-Soviet carrier they were supposed to buy, years behind schedule, billions of dollars over budget, and the Indians are now thinking, well, in the future, we'll just buy American if we can.
Is this the start of a new, perhaps, naval arms race in the region? Just last week, I believe it was, Japan launched its largest destroyer since World War II. Of course, China is building its very own aircraft carrier. There are a bunch of geopolitical issues when it comes to island disputes in the region. How are all those different relationships going to play?
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, we know that East Asia quite well. We know Japan is building these ships. We know submarine arms race is certainly going on. And there's deep concern about China's carrier plans. India plays a fascinating role in this for two reasons. One of them is it has a potential to be a pivotal state. It can tip the balance of power completely if it joins in on the side of all those states allied against China. But the second reason is that it's really ambivalent. It's not sure whether it wants to participate in a big balancing coalition against China. And therefore, you see its reaction to things like multilateral naval exercises. It's cancelled those on many occasions, saying, no, we'll only have bilateral exercises. We don't want to irk the Chinese. So actually, whether India will become part of this big concert of naval powers, part of this Asian arms race, isn't yet decided. They're still very, very ambivalent about being sucked into what they see as this US plan to contain China. And they say, no, we are our own state, we have our own objectives, and we'll make our own naval decisions.
A huge amount of Indian military spending is, of course, always been focused on what happens across the border to its west in Pakistan. But yes. Is there any reaction from Pakistan from the kind of growth of such a big kind of naval military machine?
Absolutely, and part of the reaction has been developed. Well, part of the reaction to general military modernization has been developing tactical nuclear weapons to say we can offset your big conventional strength. On the naval side, I think they've realized they can't compete on things like carriers. They're just well beyond Pakistan, so why bother? But on the nuclear submarines, there is a status thing going on here. Technically, you don't need a submarine to counter a submarine. Your land-based missiles will do fine for deterrence. But if you talk to Pakistanis, they'll say, well, if India has a submarine, we'll need a nuclear submarine. And I, you know, very very highest levels of Pakistan's nuclear infrastructure believe this.
Shashank, we're going to have to unfortunately leave it there. Fascinating stories, as always. A real pleasure having you here in the studio. Shashank Joshi, a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Many thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
And coming up, we return to Egypt.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and on to Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on Monocle.com.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of their best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Now, as you will have heard in our headlines and from Shashank, the crisis in Egypt continues to spiral out of control after a brutal crackdown by the military on Wednesday. Early reports suggest that 300 people have been killed and more than 2,000 seriously injured. Authorities raided pro-Morsi camps across the country, but most of the violence was centred in Cairo's Nahda Square and near the Raba al-Adiwa Mosque. A Muslim Brotherhood spokesman claimed that nearly 2,000 people have been killed.
Interim Prime Minister Hazem Beblawi defended the crackdown, saying it was necessary to restore order and peace in the country. A state of emergency and a curfew was imposed on Wednesday night. It will last for 1 month. While world leaders have condemned the crackdown, saying it was a serious blow to the democratic political process. Well, joining us now on the line to discuss this further is our regular Cairo correspondent Abdel Rahman Hussein. And here in the studio is Abdel Latif Al-Mawani, who's the former head of news for Egyptian state television and now a journalist here in London. But we will go to Abdel Rahman Hussein first in Cairo. It was the curfew was imposed last night at 9 p.m. Abdel, what was the scenes there overnight?
Well, Cairo is a veritable ghost town. There was practically nobody in the streets, but that was the case since the crackdown began early morning yesterday. It remained so at night, but there were sporadic clashes and gunfire could be heard at the places where the Muslim Brotherhood supporters had set up alternative sit-ins in two other locations in Cairo, and those were also clashes were ongoing throughout the night.
Now, we're hearing very varied numbers of the numbers killed, but it does seem to be an extraordinary slaying of people. I guess it's very difficult for the Egyptian media to reflect much of the story this morning. But as Cairo woke up today, what was the feeling about what had happened? And is there any support in the country, really, for what took place yesterday?
In all honesty, there is popular support for this crackdown, unfortunately. The death toll currently is at 327. I would expect the number to rise as the day goes on. But a state of emergency has been called. There's a climate of fear, and it was a gross miscalculation what happened, and it doesn't bode well for the future.
Could you just unpack that for us a little bit? Why are so many people, even now, you know, when they see the numbers of people killed, still willing to back the military?
Because the Egyptian media, as it has always been the case, has trumped up rhetoric against the Muslim Brotherhood, calling them terrorists, framing it within the paradigm that this is a fight against terrorism, and basically charging people's emotionally against the sit-ins constitutes a threat. There's also been great violence in Sinai. There were also reprisal attacks yesterday from the Muslim Brotherhood supporters. They were attacking churches all over Egypt. At least 11 churches were attacked. But Abdel Fattah Sisi, who was the Minister of Defense, have called on Egyptians to march to give him a mandate to combat this terrorism. And they had done so, many people had done so, and they had been waiting for the sit-ins to be dispersed.
Abdel Rahman Hussein, thanks very much for that check-in from Cairo. That's Monocle's Cairo correspondent, Abdel Rahman Hussein. Well, joining us here in the studio, as I mentioned, is Abdel Latif El Mawani. He is the former head of news for Egyptian state television and now a journalist here in London. Abdel, many thanks for coming onto the program. Horrendous scenes over yesterday from Cairo. Hundreds dead, thousands injured. Do you support what the military did yesterday?
I just would like to correct something. It wasn't the military who did it yesterday. It was the security forces, and this is very important. It was the state who did that yesterday. The military didn't interfere at all. Until now in this...
But it was the military chiefs that ordered this crackdown.
There is a state, there is a prime minister, there is a president, they give these orders. All right, this is the order has been made by the state, by the government, not by the minister of defense. This is number one, and we should be clear about that, and we should be accurate about that. This is number one. Number two, I'm completely against any kind of violence. I'm completely against any dead person in Egypt because of that. But we should look, why did this happen? Who is the responsible for that? Is the responsible the government? Is it the army? Is it the people themselves? Or they are the Muslim Brotherhood leaders themselves who pushed hard to reach to this point? This is the main point I think we should understand, and we should look at it. The Muslim Brotherhood, we should understand that they are the leaders of them. They pushed hard from the beginning to reach to this point. They have two options. The first option for them is to gain the power back again at the will of the Egyptian. The second option is to be victimized, to have this hundreds or thousands of injuries and kill people. This is the way of thinking. I believe that we should try to understand the way of thinking, the base of thinking, how do they think about that? And now we can just blame the responsible for that. Your correspondent mentioned quickly that there is the feed, the what they did after what happened yesterday. It wasn't just 17 churches. It was till 2 a.m. this morning. It was 19 churches has been burned. They attacked something like 17 police station, and they killed. There's few officers has been beheaded in their offices. This is the reaction of the people who want to rule Egypt. So again,
Abdel, if we agree that there's been extraordinary brutal violence on both sides, where does it leave Egypt this morning? Because you know, as you look at the country, it seems that there are two options. There's going to be either the imposition of a very brutal military dictatorship to quell any activity on the streets and to, you know, to put out any all those initial hopes for democracy, or there's going to be civil war. It seems to be very unlikely that we're going to end up, you know, we see Ban Ki-moon, you know, talking about, you know, there should be some inclusive dialogue. There doesn't seem to be any arena for that to happen for a long, long time.
I believe that we should, when we look to the picture, we should look at, to the picture from all the sides of the picture. We cannot just concentrate in one part and ignore the other parts. For more than a month, there is international official came to Egypt. And they had been allowed to come to Egypt to meet all the parties, even if it's just a group against the nation, as I called it, and as most of the Egyptians are looking at them, they had been approved for them to meet them. They met them, and what they found the main part of Muslim Brotherhood character, the denial. They denied anything happening in Egypt. They denied that there is a change had been made. They deny that there's millions of people, they already get rid of them, even if undemocratic way.
What happens this morning? Are we headed for dictatorship or civil war?
No, we are not going to dictatorship. We are heading to a democratic state, but under the state of law. This is the main thing it has to be.
Well, Abdel, let's just leave it there. Let's talk about General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. He's the military chief, the general. World leaders were pressuring him for weeks not to do this crackdown. You know, the United States, the European Union, they were pressuring him not to do this brutal crackdown. But for no reason, he decided to go and do it after 6 weeks of these camps. There's an interesting editorial today in the Jerusalem Post calling him Egypt's new king. Is this what's happening?
This is not true, actually. This is not correct. Again, there is no one against when you have a peaceful demonstration or a peaceful camp. But when you live in Cairo or in Alexandria or anywhere, and you discover that this thousands of people, they decided every day, every morning, to have demonstration in every part of the critical area of the traffic. So when you have the city paralyzed, completely paralyzed, when you have support, when this group was supporting what happened in Egypt and in Sinai, no one of them said that what happened in Sinai is violence, is terrorist. They didn't even apologize for what they have done to Egypt at 30s and 40s. Here in UK, when you had IRA came back to the political act, they already apologized for what they did for the Black Friday, Black Sunday, so for the Bloody Friday. No one from Muslim Brotherhood did that before. They just want one thing, to take the power. And I believe that there is no country all over the world has a relation with international organization. And this international organization doesn't look to the country as a country, but as a part of their Ummah, as they call it, their Islamic State. They didn't work for the people. This is the reality. This is the situation. And this is what we have to look at.
And finally,
when you are talking...
Can I finally say to you, you know, if you were the leader of any opposition party in the Arab world today, you must think, you know, they won an election, a democratic election that people say was fair. And after 1 year, they're thrown out. You say there should be a return to democracy. It seems a hopeless call for anybody to believe in democracy if you're going to be thrown out by your military after 1 year.
My friend, I believe that you need to have a deep look to the year they have ruled Egypt. They came through a democratic tool, not a democratic process. That voting is one tool of the democratic understanding, the whole democratic. And they rule at that time undemocratically at all. Look at the constitution, look to the Christians, look to the young people, look to the women. They are not there. No one of them was there. We were in the way to have a sort of dictator, Islamic dictatorship. It was sort of fascist regime we are going to have. And I'm completely against the comparison between the Tiananmen Square and what happened in Egypt. What happened in Egypt was a big mistake. We are all of us are sorry for all the blood we are having today. But again, we are blaming the main one to be blamed actually for that is the Muslim Brotherhood leaders who are already, they are just trying to push hard to push hard to have the power back again.
Adele, we're just going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for coming on the program, and lots of things that I'm sure will develop over the next couple of days and weeks, and lots to discuss as always. But many thanks for coming on the program. Abdel Latif Al-Mawani, thanks very much. After this very short break, we'll be getting a check of the world news headlines, and we'll also be heading to the UK's first ever witch exhibition.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
So we have lots coming up in the next second half of the program. We'll be looking through the French front pages today. We'll also be heading to Melbourne to get a check of what's making news down there in Australia. And we'll also find out if city maps can change the way you behave. But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Further violent clashes are feared in Egypt later, a day after hundreds of people were killed when the government ordered the crushing of camps of supporters of the deposed President Mohamed Morsi. The health ministry says at least 235 people were killed with 2,000 injured, but the Muslim Brotherhood claims the death toll was nearer 2,000. Among those killed was an experienced British TV cameraman. 61-year-old McDean had worked for Sky News for 15 years. The US soldier Bradley Manning has apologised for handing state secrets over to the WikiLeaks website in the biggest breach of classified data in the country's history. He faces up to 90 years in prison. Zimbabwe's Movement for Democratic Change says it'll continue to challenge Robert Mugabe's election victory. It's calling for the result to be declared null and void, and they're taking their case to this weekend's meeting of regional heads of state being held in Malawi. Two former JP Morgan employees are facing criminal charges in relation to the trading scandal that cost the bank $6.2 billion. The pair are charged with wire fraud and a conspiracy to falsify books and records related to the trading losses. A stuntman who parachuted into the Olympic Stadium dressed as James Bond during last year's opening ceremony has been killed during a wing diving event in Switzerland. Former Army officer Mark Sutton crashed into a ridge after jumping from a helicopter at a height of nearly 11,000 feet. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at 9 o'clock in the morning, the top of the hour, for another check of your world headlines. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Andrew Tuck. Now, Francisco de Goya's sketch Repulsive Brujas. Albrecht drew a couching woman riding backwards on the back of a goat to symbolize the devil. Picasso said about his masterpiece Les Demoiselles d'Avignon that it was his first exorcism painting.
Well, witchcraft and the themes linked to sorcery have fascinated artists for centuries. And that may be because they were always set on portraying women as either hags or seductresses. Well, that's what the first ever UK exhibition called Witches and Wicked Bodies claims, at least. And we're on the line now with Patricia Allison, the Deputy Director of the Scottish National Gallery in Edinburgh, where the exhibition is being held. Welcome to the show, Patricia. I was looking through some of the pictures this morning, and an extraordinary range of images. And I think we should perhaps remind ourselves that many of these were done at a time when people really did believe in witches. But when you began to pull this collection together from all the different museums, what were the themes that came out?
Well, the exhibition was externally curated by someone who's been very interested in drawings for a long time. And she'd been noticing that there was a particular strand of drawings of women, images of women, which were particularly unpleasant, shall I say, not very nice images of women, usually symbolizing ideas, negative ideas of things like evil and heresy and envy. And artists often, when trying to visualize those sort of abstract concepts, often chose an image of an old, ugly woman to help them do that. And it was just a short sort of segue from that into looking at witches, since there was a particular strand of these images that looked at that sort of particular type of woman. And there seemed to be a lot of consistency in it. And they're in the exhibition, as you've just said, we've got, when you gather everything together, there are images of, a lot of images of witches as horrible old crones, and they're horrible words, but really it does describe what they are. but also very beautiful, very dangerous young women, a subject which has interested artists for a long time, particularly male artists. And there seems to be this real dichotomy between the two ways of seeing witches. And that's the sort of general underlying current.
And Patricia, some of these images, they span 500 years. And some of the very first images we have of witches, they were portrayed to be completely naked, flying by moonlight. But now when you look at kind of your typical image of a witch today, it's usually a green witch. She's got a huge hat, a pointed nose, wearing a black gown. How has that evolved then from that the images we saw hundreds of years ago of naked women flying by moonlight to what we have today?
When images start, and particularly the Western images, which start in sort of late 15th century, it was a time when people were interested in things like the Renaissance, and very often you do get images of naked people. And there was this idea that if you really want to see what somebody's about, you depict them naked because they can't hide anything. And so that's when you get a lot of images of really bad people early on, and really good people completely naked, like divine goddesses, ancient goddesses. More recently, and I think it does reflect changes in time and I suppose an interest in storytelling, and that sort of focus on nudity sort of goes, but witches remain. And there are things that are constant, such as the focus on old women and women who were really past, could almost be men, some of them. They've lost any sort of youthful, attractive female qualities. And that continues, but particularly in more recent ones, you do get, most of them are closed, I think many people would be pleased to know. and also the idea of the hat is really interesting, because that's a really sort of constant image now, but you don't get that early on at all. If anything, you get women wearing hoods and hiding under shawls in the 18th and early 19th centuries, but it's only relatively recently that you see the hats.
And Patricia, there are some later examples of witches drawn by women as well. What happens when women get behind the canvas?
Oh, it becomes really interesting, because then in a way it reminds you that many of the images, the early images, are by men, perhaps because artists such as Cindy Sherman and Kiki Smith really exaggerate the features that have become the sort of safe features of fairy tale and children's stories. But when you look at it and analyze it and maybe home in on particular bits of the images, they're not kind images, they're unpleasant images. And so an artist such as Cindy Sherman, who puts herself in the photograph, has really exaggerated that by putting on a false chin, false nose, and covered her face with warts, and really makes it clear that what you're looking at is an image of a very old and very unpleasant woman in a way.
Well, Patricia, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That's Patricia Allison, who's the Deputy Director of the Scottish National Gallery. And it was great that Phil came dressed up for the part as well.
Makeup and all. I'm green.
That wart looks good. Next, we're going to do The Urbanist.
Andrew, were you ever scared of witches growing up as a kid?
You're frightening me now. No.
I don't
really remember being scared of witches. I was scared of Doctor Who.
I was scared of witches from Wizard of Oz, you know?
And do you know that Witches, that musical, is, I think, it's the most successful musical.
Wicked.
Wicked. I mean, Witches, I've changed its name. The musical about witches, I think it's turned out to be the most profitable musical ever.
I haven't seen it, have you?
Yes.
Do you ever sing the songs? I only know that one song, Eternity, isn't it?
Yeah, I must be the only person who didn't enjoy it.
Really?
Yeah. There you go. I'll tell you about it later.
Take that, witches.
I'll spoil it.
Now, this week, The Urbanist is flicking and clicking through London's maps, past and present. What it means for a city and its residents to have such a healthy catalogue of maps at their disposal, why we love them, and how they dictate the way we feel.
Well, to kick things off, I sat down with two men that are part of London's mapping future. They are Tim Fenley of Applied, the design agency responsible for map signposts around London, and Kevin Brown, digital director at Brothers and Sisters, who developed the Museum of London's acclaimed app, Street Museum.
And we will start with that very special app and a success story of a digital map truly opening up the city.
One of the things that they were really heavily trying to target was trying to bring Londoners who go about the city all day but never actually get to the museum. So the idea was to try and release some of that content and put it into the hands of Londoners themselves. So we took augmented reality technology, and by using this app, you can essentially be standing in a location and look down the street and see how your street looked when it was bombed during the war, or look all the way up Carnaby Street and see what it looked like in the 60s. But it was essentially a kind of time tunnel to re-explore and sort of strip back the sort of modern wallpaper of where you stand and actually be able to see the past.
And how popular have they been?
Well, they wanted 5,000 downloads on that, and within about the third week of us launching this, which was 2009, we did about 75,000 downloads. And it seems to be the gift that keeps on giving, because it's become a bit of a legacy product for them, and it's sort of redefined how they communicate with Londoners. So things that are tentpole events for them, be it Dickens or be it Roman London, they always use digital technology now to actually enhance that experience. So as well as the guidebook or the brochure, you've always got a piece of digital information there, which essentially is sort of freeing up the city and is a kind of bait, really, to try and move people from the streets that they're in to the museum. In a later app that we did for Dickens, which is called Dickens.London, it was a series of interactive graphic novels. But what we did was actually reward people who went to the locations in which they were set by getting a free download of that particular edition of the app itself, because it came as a series of partworks, much like Dickens released his own work. So, you know, the whole thing has always been trying to move people through, but it's actually trying to sort of focus Londoners into what they've got around them and actually trying to sort of map that city and give them a real sort of sense of where they stand.
And Kevin, tell me that figure, 75,000, what does that say about us? There can't be that many kind of history teachers wandering around London.
No, I think it's certainly looking at the numbers. I mean, last year in the Olympics, we had the whole suite of the apps, the Roman London one, the Dickens app and the original Street Museum were all featured in the iTunes store as part of a 2012 Get Amongst the City. And Street Museum now has done 400,000 odd downloads, and many, many, many of those are from abroad, especially the States. And I think it's got a lot of press worldwide, so people just download it and use it as a sort of tool. I mean, the great thing about it is that although you can do this augmented reality experience by standing in the street and have this great sort of view of how London used to look, the app itself actually reacquaints people with the city in which they are in, and you can do it sort of without being in the location. So it works on two levels. It's there to try and move people through the streets, but it's also there to try and re-educate them about the places in which they find themselves.
Tim, I think what's interesting is, you know, that you imagine that because everyone has these one or two kind of generic types of map applications on their phones, that it would have killed off interest in other maps. But a theme that will come up throughout the show is the people we've met and we're going to meet, they all believe that actually maps have never been more interesting and more people interested in them. Why is that?
I wonder what your question was going to be. I think actually, if you look back, we were starting to lose our interest in maps or our ability to use them when with SatNav, you know, there's a number of people who found SatNav a lot better than trying to use an AA map, which is how we all used to do it. And SatNav, you know, who was it, the head of the OS was going on about it's damaging map reading. We don't really get taught map reading at school unless you take it up as an interest of orienteering. I think mapping is very much a learned skill, being able to read a map and use a map. And I don't think maps have been designed very well in modern times. You know, the old OS maps were beautiful. The modern A to Z has its use, but you can't walk around with it. So I think they're better designed. They're getting better designed. And then the Google Maps came out, and the, you know, I used to use another map called Map Info, and they really allowed, you know, more availability, meant we actually started using them again. And the demand for these maps and knowing where you are is quite, I think, quite considerable. And I think they're now more available and they're better designed. I think they're a long way to go.
It does feel that a bit maybe like a family tree or something, that a map allows us to know where we sit in the world. All of the maps, certainly the app versions of them, place you right at the heart of the world. There is a universe that spins out to infinity, but you're the dot in the middle. Do you think that's part of our affection? You know, when you personally use maps and when you use maps on your phone, is it that bleeping dot in the center of the screen that makes you feel, okay, I know my world, I know my neighborhood, the city that spreads out from me?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's, that's really human, isn't it? That I'm in the middle of my world. I think the other thing that we really found from the research that we did is that people are quite worried about an environment that they're not that familiar with. So something that gives them clues and guidance and knowledge about what's near actually makes you feel more safe, more relaxed, and more certain. And I think that's a really important, we found that to be one of the most, because our maps were intended to allow movement. We found the need for certainty was really, really high in people's hierarchy. They wouldn't say it in research, but that's what we read from all the research that we watched. So they want to know, is it down there? How far is it? How am I going the right direction? All these things. And while you can trust in a sat-nav, when you're walking in a city, sat-navs, I think, are really inappropriate for walking. I can't see myself walking around strapped to the front of my chest. So actually having something that gives you much more of a picture of the environment with you in the middle is really what people have been looking for.
What a fascinating idea that our kind of use of the city, our feelings of, you know, security and safety, and actually how far we'll venture before we fear here be dragons, is down to good old-fashioned cartography. Is that something you've found as well?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think, you know, what all of these things are is a brilliant sort of collaboration of science and art. And people are, you know, in the same way that if you buy a flat and you wonder how many people have been in that flat before you, and you strip back wallpaper and you see all the different layers that have gone on in the past, it's another way of actually plotting your relationship with the city and reacquainting yourself with the city and actually sort of getting a sense of self.
Well, that, Phil, is award-winning radio.
That was good. That was a good interview.
Well, that was Kevin Brown and Tim Fenley speaking to me for The Urbanist. And you can catch the full interview and hear more about the ways in which a city is mapped tonight at 1900 hours London time.
It's a very good show, The Urbanist. I would recommend it highly to all of our listeners out there. I am obsessed with maps on your phone, aren't you? Are you the same?
I am, but what's interesting is that everyone's saying, we went to amazing to the British Library, they have a collection of maps going back to like the 1300s of London, and they're saying that never have people been so interested in maps, and it's partly begun with those digital maps. Suddenly people are really interested in them, so they have an amazing collection, so we get to rustle through those as well.
I find it quite fascinating when you see people walking around, they still have the big old-fashioned maps, you know, and their arms are all wide open and they're standing there on the street.
Well, in the show we print off a giant map of London with me at the centre of it. That's how the world should be.
With you at the centre, that you heard it there first. You are listening to Midori House. The time is 17:46 in Melbourne and 8:46 in the morning here in London. We're going to be heading to Australia next for our check-in with our correspondent on the Monocle Network.
And today we're going to be joined from Melbourne by Patrick Pittman. Hello, Patrick.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Now, we have touched earlier on today on the elections in Australia, but we're desperate to find out that something else is happening down there as well. And I thought perhaps we could start with this refugee story about Nauru and what's happening, an endless battle about what happens to asylum seekers, and Fiji, which doesn't exactly have the best reputation in the world either, actually having a little bit of a go at Australia.
Yeah, it's all sort of getting very interesting out there in the South Pacific. Some of the first asylum seeker families who are going to be sent to detention centres on Nauru and in Papua New Guinea could be heading there within the next few weeks, according to the Labour government. And despite the fact that many of their own backbenchers have started to speak out loudly against things, I think now that they know the election is not looking so winnable as it was, they're being a bit more vocal on these things. But yeah, so just recently Fiji's foreign minister spoke out against what seems to be Australia going to all of the various countries who they do pump a lot of aid into, it should be said, and suggesting that they might like to consider taking on some of these detention centres. And they did mention countries such as Vanuatu and the Solomons as possibly places that might end up having to also be part of this policy.
And that announcement by Kevin Rudd a couple of weeks ago, where that he would send his new kind of asylum seeker policy, you know, I guess it came as a shock to many people in that country, many people on both sides of the argument. Now that it has been a couple of weeks, do we know how that decision has been playing in the election?
What that did in terms of the election is it basically neutralized an issue. We've had a couple of weeks of only talking about refugee issues, and now we've sort of moved on from that, and it's something that neither side can fight on because they basically were just arguing as to who was tougher, and there's only so far you can take that one until people start to tune out.
And now, just tell me also, the Commonwealth Bank has posted huge profits of $7.8 billion. It's Australia's biggest bank, now the 10th biggest in the world. Some of the news coming out of Australia on the economy front hasn't been so great of late. Is this something for the country to be proud about?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Australia is very proud of its banks riding out the global financial crisis and being in the kind of position they're in, but they're also generally not ever been particularly a fan of those banks that they protected. And so this is a bit of an interesting one, and it is kind of built on a lot of borrowing and on some particularly low interest rates. And, you know, you've got to start thinking about when interest rates are as low as they are right now, and, you know, the dollar's starting to drop to a slightly lower level, and people are starting to get concerned about asset bubbles and the like.
And Patrick, another issue which has managed to move the election off the front pages of Australia's papers is all about Aussie rules football, the AFL. Of course, the AFL final will be, I think it's in about 6 weeks from now, over there in Melbourne at the MCG. But Essendon has been charged by the anti-doping agency.
Yes, so this is a story that initially broke back in February and just really shocked the sporting community, particularly here in Melbourne. Aussie rules is particularly a Melbourne, a Victorian kind of sport. And this has been very much the first thing to move the election off the front page on the local paper, The Age, and also the Herald Sun here in the last few days. This has been a big one. The anti-doping authority has charged four staff from the club, including their coach, James Hurd, who's an absolute club legend, with what they call bringing the game into disrepute. It's a little vague so far as to what that actually means, but it is directly related to an ongoing program of administering peptide supplements to the players a couple of years back.
And the way that this story has broken it is, you know, happening in lots of sports around the world, but there's reports that that none of the players are going to be charged. It's just the coaches are going to be hit. Why is that?
Well, that's how it stands at the moment. The authority hasn't ruled out charging the players, but they have said at this point none are going to be charged. That's largely because these players were being administered with supplements by their club doctor, who has also been fired. There was a sports scientist. The sports scientist they had has been fired. The club doctor has just been charged. And, you know, they were just kind of doing what they were told was good for them, and these were just vitamin supplements. Now, you know, if you took that to global tribunals, that doesn't stand up as a defense. And never has. So it's an interesting one to say that the players are getting off entirely scot-free here, and we'll wait to see how that actually plays out in the courts.
Thanks very much, Patrick. We are going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Patrick Pittman there is our man in Melbourne.
Now, in a moment, we'll be reading the French front pages with our Parisian producer, Daphne Denis. But let's listen first to an up-and-coming Franco-British band, one of her favourites, I hear. This is The Night Six with Thinking of You. Well, that was The Night Six with Thinking of You. And before we move into the French headlines, they're friends of yours, aren't they?
They are, they are. Well,
so you're doing band promoting on this station as well
indeed.
Now.
I'm sorry. They're a really good band, though, and I went to their album release yesterday.
And they have a harp.
And they have a harp, which is quite wonderful, I have to say. I don't think you can get any cooler than being a pop rock band with a harp.
Well, it's a bit difficult when you go on tour, though, especially in the early days, trying to get it in the overhead luggage.
I think it makes them edgy.
Excess baggage. Well, Daphne, thanks very much for joining us here in the studio. You've got a couple of the French front pages for us. So where should we begin?
Yes, let's begin with politics. French politics, always as exciting as ever. Ish, I guess. I'm laughing at this myself. Basically, the cracks in Hollande's cabinet are starting to show, and that's because there's been this big division between the French Interior Minister and the French Justice Minister. They're supposed to work together, obviously, you know, the police and the justice system, they're supposed to be together. But the French Interior Minister just said that he's completely opposed to a reform of the justice system, the criminal justice system. And that basically shows that you have two sides of the French government at the moment. There's the sort of right-leaning side, which is his side, and then the sort of more socialist side, which is the Minister of Justice. And I think Hollande is really having a really hard time choosing which side he's on.
So at the heart of this is a discussion about whether the time that mainly petty criminals spend in jail should be reduced, or they shouldn't go to jail at all.
It's basically the French penal code. I don't know if you've ever seen a penal code.
Like, if you've ever been sent to a French jail. How bad do you think I am?
I don't know. They're just like this really, really big book. And, you know, France has trouble passing any type of reforms, but that kind of reform is a difficult thing. So people are going to jail for longer terms at times, and, you know, the jails are overcrowded. So there needs to be change. And one of Hollande's big electoral pledges was that he was going to change that. He was going to help people get out of jail sooner if they just committed a delit, what we call a delit.
Because Hollande is not having a very good time in office, is he? His approval ratings last month were the lowest they've ever been, something like 29% approval rating. Do you think he's trying to make crime and justice, one of his key priorities in a bid to maybe get back some of that popularity?
I mean, I think he is, because the French are obviously obsessed with like every type of social reforms. I think economy is obviously the most important thing that he needs to do, though. And I think the reason why Hollande is having a really bad time is that France has a presidential system. Our president is the most important person. And we don't have, he's not strong enough. He's not present enough. And whether we like it or not, Sarkozy was always there, so always around and always present. And that was something that, even if we hated him, we talked about him. Here we're talking about Christiane Taubira and Manuel Valls. We're not talking about Hollande. And I think that's the problem.
Now, another surprise story in the papers yesterday. This is the announcement, which you have in Le Figaro, for example, that
yes.
Marion Bartoli is resigning.
I mean,
retiring, rather.
Resigning?
Can you resign? You can't really.
I mean, resign, she kind of is resigning. It's in every single newspaper. Marion Bartoli, our tennis star, is resigning. She announced that tearfully in Ohio yesterday. It's an odd one, because I feel like the French were really proud of her at Wimbledon. But at the same time, it's really weird reading the stories that have been written about her. It's always like, oh, well, you know, she was good, but really she has kind of a unfortunate physique. So, you know, it was always kind of hard for her. She had to work really hard to become a champion. So, too bad.
And she also blamed a series of injuries that she's been fighting off. She had Achilles heels problems and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think, I mean, she's quite old for a professional tennis player. And I think she said that she's just been working too hard and that she's just too tired.
And very quickly, Daphne, Asterix and Obelisk. It's got a new writer? What's happening?
Yes, well, that's an iconic. It's like it's the equivalent of Tintin in France. Asterix and Obelix, it's like this story about French Gaulois in Rome. And it's an iconic series. And it was written by Goscinny, who's our Roald Dahl. And yes, there's a new writer is there. And I think I'm going to look into it, but I'm not sure I'm convinced that
I was more of an Archie kind of guy. How about you, Andrew?
Archie? Who's Archie?
Archie Comics.
I don't know who Archie is.
You've never heard of Archie.
Is that a Korean?
Maybe it's not a Korean thing. It's a North American. Always with the Korean. Okay, well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Danny Giacopelli, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilya Simos, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is Culture with Robert Bound. I'll be back with Sophie Grove with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.